This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Valentine's Day is this weekend, a multi-billion dollar boon for retailers and restaurants serving celebrating couples. Spending by young, affluent singles, however, may have even greater revenue potential, at least in China, where Singles Day far outpaces spending on Valentine's Day, Black Friday, and Cyber Monday for online sales. What started off as a fun day for anti-couple crusaders to karaoke and go on blind dates has been rebranded by Chinese viral superstore Alibaba as a day for the unattached to treat themselves to online splurges. It is now the largest online shopping day in the world by far. Leanne Chen is a reporter for Forbes, where she wrote about Singles Day in China. And Leanne, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the history of Singles Day in China?
So there are many different versions of how it started, but the holiday was actually really invented by Tmall.com, which is one of Alibaba's leading e-commerce sites. They invented this 24-hour sale 5 years ago in 2009 to really take advantage of when young people in mainland to encourage them to either celebrate or lament being single. The holiday gets its name, there are four ones in its name because it's on November 11th. And it looks like four bear sticks, which in Chinese it means guanguan, which refers to guys who are single.
So it sort of started as a single guys holiday?
Yeah, so it started as like in college where it became popular in dorms where single guys just want to hang out and either celebrate or lament being being alone.
So is it celebrated widely in China or is this a kind of urban phenom?
It's pretty urban. It really started out as a phenomenon in colleges, in urban cities, and then it kind of started out now really across the country. Still, the main force is among the biggest cities, but some second-tier cities and rural area have started to join it online as well.
So how do singles mark the day today? Any specific things that they do besides apparently buy things?
Well, that's actually one of the biggest part is that they go and buy things for other people. It's increasingly become like a online shopping holiday for them. And of course, there are people who just kind of go out on dates and try to use it as an excuse to go and hang out and go sing karaoke with their group of friends.
That all sounds like they're sort of celebrating, but I'm interested in the lamentation here. People even hire fake significant others on Singles Day. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so definitely there's this element that, you know, being single is not necessarily something to be proud of sometimes in Chinese cultures. There's pressure from traditional value and from family. So sometimes guys and women would invite their friends. And in some extreme cases, there may be fake significant others to invite them for dinner. But that's not that common. And in general, I think most people actually celebrate it rather than just complaining about it.
And they're buying gifts for others, not necessarily for themselves. Or is that
sometimes
part of
it too? Buy it for themselves too? It's just kind of like a Thanksgiving here, mostly buying it for others, but also a way to reward themselves.
Why do you think this has taken off so much in China, and why at this particular time?
Well, I think in general, I think it really coincides with the boom of e-commerce in China. Young people, especially the young urban type, really start to take advantage of online shopping, just like this here in the U.S. So it was very shrewd of Alibaba and its sites to really take advantage of this trend. And also just in general, I think there's a lot of self-mocking culture going on with the boom of internet and technology in China. So people like to make fun of themselves online.
Well, last year, Singles Day broke the world record for highest online sales revenues generated by a single company in a single day. Leanne, do you think this is a kind of barometer of anti-Valentine's Day sentiment, or is this just, you know, another great reason to buy?
I think it's a combination of both. I think people really see it as an advantage of great opportunity to buy because there are a lot of good sales going on, just like Thanksgiving and Black Friday here. But on the other hand, I think the boom and the development of internet culture in China really provides the opportunity for people to mock themselves and take this as an advantage to enjoy the holiday and make fun and hang out, have fun with their friends.
Well, now that Alibaba has made this huge global IPO, are there plans to make Singles Day work elsewhere?
I think Alibaba is really trying to push it for to around the world, too. I mean, with Chinese people, there are a lot of Chinese immigrants around the world. They're trying to encourage them to shop on this day, too. And I think eventually their ambition is to promote this to even people from of, you know, different cultures around the world. Now, whether that's successful or not, only time will tell. But so far, they've been trying really hard to, you know, connect with international retailers, at least to attract the Chinese consumers.
I can't help but think of Beyoncé's hit, you know, All the Single Ladies, which became this kind of anthem for women making demands or wanting to get married. Do you think that Singles Day as a concept would take off in the U.S. in the same way?
I think it could be. In China, obviously, there's culturally, there's much more pressure on being single. The values are relatively more conservative. So definitely there are young people feeling the pressure to not be single. But in here in the U.S., I think relatively that pressure is lower. But people can still have fun like they do in China.
Well, Leanne Chen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Leanne Chen is a reporter for Forbes, but that's where we found her article. Happy Singles Day, China's anti-Valentine's Day festival. It's the world's biggest e-commerce holiday. You can read it for yourself. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. So whether it's calculating spending by singles or following our Fitbit miles, tracking personal data has become a hobby slash obsession in the information age. So what if somebody took all that digital information you leave behind and turned it into an infographic, your entire life in a series of charts and graphs? Our next story is of a man who did just that, and it comes to us from Roman Mars of 99% Invisible and producer Nate Berg.
The 2009 Feltron Annual Report.
From this moment on, I want you to record every encounter you have with another person.
Total encounters.
Each mode of transportation.
Methods of transportation, 23.
Like if I walk through the door, I'm writing down the name of that store.
Total locations reported, 258.
I just want to know every single place that I go.
That's Nicholas Felton, aka Feltron.
I'm just trying to build a super rich data set.
Data sets that he will interrogate at the end of the year, designing pie charts and bar graphs that are used to create a concise infographic that tells the story of Nicholas Felton's year.
Is it going to be through the lens of like my favorite ATM, or is it going to be through the person I spend the most time with?
Most encounters with one person, 226.
He calls the beautifully designed result the Feltron Annual Report.
Well, the thing that's really relatable about this report...
That is the voice of freelance journalist Nate Berg. He interviewed Felton in New York for us.
Not only is it clear and kind of easy to understand in the sort of graphs and pie charts that we've all gotten used to seeing all over the place, but, I mean, it's presenting stuff directly kind of out of my own life, too.
New York restaurants visited 111.
How many restaurants did I go to last year? How many beers did I drink?
Ice cream flavors consumed, 9.
These are all things that I do, and having the data and the ability to present it helps draw that connection between two essentially strangers.
All the easy dismissive criticisms about Foursquare check-ins and Twitter should be popping into your mind right now. They all boil down to this. Why do I care about what you had for breakfast this morning? And I get that. But a funny thing happens when you take what you had for breakfast this morning and multiply it by 100 of its quotidian equivalents and multiply that times 365.
He's doing exactly what everyone else is doing, but he's just doing it in a more purposeful way. It's not only that he wants to track what's happening and kind of see how his life changes over time, but present it in a way that's digestible to himself and to other people, even strangers.
What Nicholas Felton creates with all that sprawling information superficially resembles a corporate quarterly report, but it's the most beautiful version of that that you could possibly imagine. A true work of art.
Most consecutive exclamation marks used, 8.
2008 was a pretty boring year. I didn't travel very much, so the highlights were like first ice cream of the year, but you know, it's this elaborate piece of design work that took weeks to create and cost thousands of dollars to produce to document this like one tiny memory that would have been totally lost otherwise. It's my favorite way of telling stories now. It's this way of making things that are either invisible or too large to be comprehended, making them visible, rather than the abstractions of looking at tables of numbers. These are pretty compelling and memorable ways of revealing invisible stories.
It puts more focus on the little things that make up most of your time. Your life isn't really that trip that you took last summer. It's, you know, like the countable times that you kind of walk down the same way to get to your office, that one house on the corner with that crazy dog. You know, how many hours of your life have you spent listening to like Hotel California on the radio?
I have to break in here to say this is where a normal public radio show would play the song Hotel California. But I am your friend, and I would never do that to you.
That's the beauty of this kind of representation, is you can take something that represents millions or even billions of actions and reduce it to something that's consumable.
Average waters per day, 0.24. Average beers per day, 0.99.
Felton has been doing this in-depth self-reporting since 2005, but at the end of 2010, his father died, and so the 2010 annual report took on a whole new scope.
He took kind of that same approach, but applied it, you know, on a much grander scale to someone's entire life, the life of his father.
The 2010 Feltron annual report.
I didn't want my 2010 report to be the story of my father's death. I think his death is the least interesting part of his life story.
Items cataloged. 4,348.
So I wanted to make something that talked about his life.
Passport stamps, 239.
It's like writing a biography about someone. It's just in a different format, I think, and perhaps a more valid one, one that's more rooted in the facts, right? It is like a direct translation. There's very little of my opinion that shows up in here. It's further back. It's in the editing. It's in the curation that my opinion shows up.
Postcards received, 169. Photos of Gordon in record, 93. Percentage of photos of Gordon wearing a tie, 18%.
It's his life story, so it's bookended by his birth and sadly by his death. But you know, that's one of the things I want to remember about him, and I think is part of his story is that's the day he died, and that was what the weather was like, is the next statistic. I'm not trying to be shocking about it, but it needs to be in there, and I wanted to have a little repose at the end where you could sort of just absorb the end of his narrative.
Last day, September 12th, 2010.
I didn't want to dwell on sickness or know, his spirit fading. I think that's in there. If you look at a lot of the graphs, you can see a decline in meals out. It's kind of foreshadowed throughout the document that, you know, the spring in his step was diminished in his last few years. My challenge was to try and take that idea of a biography and put it in a new form that I hadn't seen before. And, you know, you have to give up on not seeing him smile, like not seeing him in motion, not hearing his voice, or, you know, listening to one of his jokes. But that's part of the aggregate view. That's part of this this grander scope that I was going for.
Weather on September 12th, 2010, 49.8 degrees Fahrenheit and overcast.
And that story was produced by Roman Mars and Nate Burke for 99% Invisible. And you can check out the 2013 Feltron report. I guess we're still waiting for him to crunch the numbers on 2014. You can just go to the link at wordofmouthradio.org. Do you ever miss the days when you simply snapped some photos, dropped off your film, and anxiously waited for it to be developed? Well, there's an app for that. Up next, we're going to reveal a new service that turns your smartphone into a disposable camera. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The rise of digital photography has forever changed how we take and view pictures. The heyday of film cameras, negatives, and the once ubiquitous one-hour Photoshop are relics of the past. And yet there's something about the old 35mm days that people really miss. That nostalgia is what Greg Beck was tapping into when he created an app called The White Album. It's a counterintuitive service that basically turns your smartphone into a disposable camera. Greg, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So let's just say that I put The White Album on my phone. How does it work?
It's really, really simple. So you get it on your phone and you take a roll, essentially, of 24 photos. And when you're done shooting, you just order them and you don't have to think about it again. And they just get sent to your door, these physical photos printed on really premium paper in a nice package.
But I don't get to look at the photographs after I've taken them.
That is the big twist. Yeah. So when you take the photos, we sort of encourage you to just be in the moment a little bit. And so you don't get to reflect on the photos immediately. There's no instant gratification. You can't edit them or post them to a social network or even delete them. You just take them and then move on. And then you get to relive these moments when they're in your hands as printed photos.
No immediate gratification in the age of the selfie. How can this be?
I know, it's crazy.
So what made you want to create something like this?
It was sort of a combination of things. I was actually, in 2013, I was with my girlfriend at the time in Korea visiting her family. And being on the other side of the world, of course, I was playing with my phone and my camera and taking lots of photos, hundreds of photos that I was taking. And so that was happening in one hand. And the other, I found myself with her family going through some of her old family photos, really old photos that, you know, I do from time to time with my family, you know, around the holidays or whatever. I wanted to be able to do that for myself in the future, have photos that I can look back on. But I also knew that despite me taking all these photos on my camera right then and there, I was pretty unlikely to actually go back and print any of them on my own. And so what I actually wanted was the ability to take a photo now and then to just have the printed photos later.
Such a good point. That ritual of going through photographs, we won't have that 20 years from now.
Yeah, it's kind of sad because whenever I do look through photos, it's amazing. You know, you relive every moment that you're looking at, and it's there forever as long as you have those photos in a box or in an album somewhere. You don't have to worry about booting up a computer or tapping into an old hard drive.
I really understand that nostalgia for the old technology and that experience, the mystery of what the photographs that you took are going to look like. But aren't you forgetting all of those rolls that you paid full price for that had, what, four or five decent photographs on them?
Yeah, so that's definitely, I think, part of the allure, actually, because we set it up so that you couldn't see the photos purposely because, A, we wanted you to stay in the moment and take the photo that you want and move on. But also there was just something interesting about that, those imperfections that you might capture. And oddly enough, when we're going through some of these old photos, be they a week old or a year old or 10 years old, some of those quirkier ones or blurry ones, just because they're not perfect or professional quality that'll be showing in a gallery somewhere, there's still something really special about that, knowing that you took it, you were there with that person, and it's okay that they blinked.
You know, I'm thinking about how we're using media now, music, movies, right? You know, the idea that everything is free. I'm wondering if you've considered, are there other places than photography where people might be actually interested in paying more to actually limit their options?
I think so. I mean, I am a designer. I come from a design background. And I think in the creative world in general, we thrive on limitations. And so when a project comes in that specifies we can't use this and we can't use that color, and we can't approach it in this way, and it has to be for this specific audience, that tends to bring out a really unique and powerful end result. And so by capping the number of photos you can take and not allowing you to actually see the photos until they're printed, we think that just brings out more creativity in the shoots themselves.
Greg Beck, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Greg Beck is the creator of The White Album. It's an app that turns your smartphone into a disposable camera. And we're going to be testing out the app, and you're invited to join us. There's a link to the app at wordofmouthradio.org. We'll be taking a few shots and be back with a review in just a couple of weeks. And from old-fashioned photo snapping, we move to another fast-fading craft, handmade shaker-style chairs. A conversation with the only man in the world who makes tappan chairs. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're from New England, it's a pretty good bet that you're familiar with shaker chairs. With their straight lines and ladder backs and latticed seats, they embody the shaker values of simplicity and functionality. Tappan chairs closely resemble their shaker cousins and were quite nearly lost to time, if not for a few craftsmen making them in Sandwich, New Hampshire, and only in Sandwich, New Hampshire, since 1819. The tappan style remains true to the shaker form, although, as reporter Sean Hurley found out, the makers, or in this case, the maker, has not.
39-year-old Adam Nudhomeyer is the only man in the world who makes tappan chairs.
We still use machinery from the 1800s. So it's not only the same machine that's been making chairs, you know, it's the same pattern, running on the same machine, you know, doing it exactly the same way.
Abraham Tappan made his first chair in 1819, so the story goes. His son Daniel powered his lathes on the currents of the Cold River.
Daniel Tappan supported 15 kids off the business. Like, he was selling chairs in Ashland, trading them, slogging them through the mud and snow to get there.
The business stayed in the Tappan family until 1939. And while there have been brief spans of inactivity along the way, Adam says the whole thing might have been lost to time if not for a local cabinet maker, Gunnar Berg.
Gunnar brought it from nothing.
As Gunnar tells it, the business came to a temporary halt in 1964, with the death of then Tappan owner Cy Bloomberg. A local airline pilot bought the Tappan equipment at auction.
He had no interest in woodworking, no expertise in woodworking. He just wanted to keep the equipment in town, in more or less one pile.
Gunner bought the pile for $300 and vowed to bring the Tappan machines back to life.
Well, that started a literally 10-year process from 1980 to 1990 of working at night to try to put together this jumble of parts and figure out how it all went together.
Despite his knowledge of tools, Gunner couldn't do it. A friend suggested he call Doc Hoag, a prior Tappan owner still living in a retirement home in Florida.
So he started talking about the Tappan lathe. Actually, he didn't start talking about the Tappan lathe. He started swearing about the Tappan lathe. Non-stop swearing. That goddamn tapping lathe.
All Gunnar learned was that the lathe he couldn't put together wouldn't be much fun if he ever did. But he persevered.
So what I used to do, because cabinet making and furniture making was a whole new thing for me, I would, in my dreams, try to resolve problems that I knew were coming up, typically the next day.
So Gunnar decided to dream about the tappan lathes.
And I used to dream about them in such detail that when I would come into the shop in the morning, I knew exactly what to do.
Berg got the old lathes running and produced his chairs from 1990 to 2005.
I really felt at that point that I had resurrected it as a business, and that was my whole intent.
He put the business up for sale and got offers from Oregon and California, but for the next 8 years, Gunnar Berg refused to sell.
I was kind of under this unspoken obligation to keep it in Sandwich.
When Adam Nutt Homeyer came to ask about the business, Gunnar felt he'd found a kindred spirit. Adam not only wanted to make the chairs in Sandwich, he also possessed an elusive but necessary quality.
I realized he was OCD enough to do that kind of work, and you have to recognize those qualities in both of us.
Well, that's
we're both freaking OCD.
Like I said, thank you. I take it as a compliment.
In 2013, Adam bought the company and set to work in his house, an old parsonage, and barn.
This is where the minister's horse and buggy were. And so these are the horse stalls.
A small delta lathe stands in each stall. No horses kept, Adam jokes, but plenty of horsepower. But the soul of the business, the tappan lathe, stands alone against the wall. Adam doesn't so much turn the mighty lathe on and watch it work.
There's this little dance that you do with it, but you know, there's kind of like a, you tighten, 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 snug, oil, turn on, run, and then you back off, loosen, slide, pull, clank. If you don't do that, you'll be paying for it.
After learning how to run the machines and make the chairs, Adam ran into a problem.
I said, I'm back at Tappan Chairs, is back in business. Anybody want to buy a chair? And everybody said, well, my great-grandparents got a set back in the early 1900s. They're still going strong.
Nobody in town needed a Tappan chair, and shipping the chairs wasn't cost-effective.
So it's like, okay, we can make these chairs, but now how do we get them to people?
The question haunted Adam for the next 2 years, until he received a call from a furniture company in Maine asking if they could represent Tappan Chairs.
And so we've gone from sort of local and regional distribution to now having a company, Chilton Furniture in Maine, has picked up our line and is going to sell us nationally.
Chilton's second request left Adam nearly speechless.
They have long had a relationship with the Last Shaker community in Sabbath Day Lake in Maine. And there had been this sort of this ongoing discussion about bringing back the chair from that community and reselling it. They're the only three Shakers left in the world.
The Shakers wanted to know if Adam was interested in becoming the steward of their chair-making tradition.
It's like, it's I can't even really put words to it. It's so incredible because this has never been done before. Like, never.
For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
And we have a little postscript to Sean's story. For the first time in their history, the Shakers at Sabbath Day Lake in Maine have authorized production of an authentic Alfred Shaker chair. While the Shakers will oversee the process, the actual chair will be made by Adam Nutt Homeyer of Sandwich, New Hampshire. Up next, we're going to take waxing nostalgic to a whole new level with the surprisingly fascinating history of hair removal and what it reveals about shifting views of racial and social status in the U.S. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The American fixation with body hair began with its first colonial settlers. Thomas Jefferson, Lewis and Clark, and other 18th century thinkers wrote at length about the seemingly hairless natives. Their smooth faces and bodies were thought to signal unmanly fragility, self-mutilation, and savagery. A similar reasoning applied to the supposed inferiority of African slaves. Some 250 years later, Americans spend billions of dollars and untold hours removing body hair as a means of beautification and empowerment. While at Guantanamo Bay, the forced shaving of detainees is considered to be a form of humiliation and even torture. Clearly, the familiar act of hair removal has meaning. Yet when Bates professor Rebecca Herzig began pursuing it as a topic of study, some of her peers deemed it too mundane, even repellent. But she pressed on and joins us now to talk about her new book, Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. Rebecca Herzig, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. It's just such a pleasure to be here.
Well, there's so many facets to this issue that I never even considered. What led you to hair removal?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard question. There are probably a lot of complicated personal reasons, but professionally, I think it really started when I was a graduate student in the history of technology. And it just seemed that the stories that were being told about technology focused almost exclusively on giant, spectacular things that few people really ever came in contact with, like nuclear weapons, say. And nuclear weapons are undeniably important, but in the history of humanity, obviously very, very few people have had any kind of contact with them. And I just got interested in a more general way about the sorts of artifacts and systems that we run into in our much more daily life and how they might shape us even more than the more spectacular things that we tend to focus on.
Well, certainly shaping policy for Native Americans, these arguments over the Indian character based on their hair eventually underscored policies that subjugated Native Americans. Tell us about some of those underlying beliefs.
The policy changed over time, but undergirding all of it, of course, was questions or really assumptions about the fundamental character of Native people. And the struggle that white settlers were having were Native peoples more or less naturally like European settlers, or were they naturally so dissimilar that they could never be acculturated or educated into European ways of life? The Native people, of course, had their own perspectives on all these issues. But just thinking from the European point of view, there was actually quite a lot of debate about whether indigenous people could ever become, quote, civilized, or whether they would always be fundamentally different. And in that sense, all these observations about body hair played a very central role in that it was one of the defining elements of racial difference, according to the European observers. So there were just treatises after treatises written about whether natives had more or less hair than Europeans naturally by birth, or whether they were somehow removing it in ways that the Europeans might not be able to see. And there were all these kind of ethnologists who went out trying to observe Native people and their practices so that they could report on what their bodies were really like. And what I suggest in the book is that those claims about Native bodies then informed policy, the assumptions about whether they could be brought into European American modes of life, or whether they were fundamentally other.
Well, and this is significant of a kind of pathologizing hair growth that we see throughout American history. In your book, reading about the dawn of the 20th century, this idea that hair growth, excessive hair growth especially, is a sign of sexual or mental or criminal deviance, and even distinction between hair types becomes a kind of form of judgment. I think is there a case where you write about specimens of hair proving the guilt or innocence of a man on trial for lunacy? Am I remembering
yes.
that correctly?
Yes, yes, yes. Whether the hair marked him as genuinely insane or not. And they studied his little hair filaments under the microscope to see whether he was genuinely insane.
Well, what was going on in American society and thinking that led to that? One of the things you point to, of course, is Darwin and Darwin's Descent of Man. What role did his discourse on denudation of man play in this theory and judgment of hair?
In Descent of Man, he took up the question of physical differences between human beings very explicitly, and hair was a giant part of that discussion for Darwin. And in the wake of that book and its hold on culture, without question, attitudes towards body hair in the U.S. started shifting. Whereas before the Descent of Man, to have no body hair in the way that European observers thought Native American bodies were was a sign of sort of peculiarity, or the word that the European observers used, deficiency. But after Darwin, having too much visible hair was considered a sign of depravity or deviance in some way. And in all the ways you mentioned, racial mental, sexual, political, all these various kinds of ideas about a difference. But Darwin has to be understood in the wider context of the professionalization of science and medicine more generally. And I think that's where some of the power over actual public opinion and public practices starts to change as people go see physicians and people read professional scientists in the public press, popular press, and so on. I think that's how the idea that experts might have something special to say about hair growth starts to take hold.
Well, we're discussing a topic not normally discussed in polite society, and that is body hair, specifically removal thereof, which our guest Rebecca Herzig found has a lot to do with race and science and industry and class in America. She covers it all in her new book called Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. So at the time that where women are fighting for access to the vote, protesting or fighting for equal education, they were seen as aggressive and manly. There's an ad that you quote from the DeMiracle Chemical Company. America may become a nation of bearded women if consumers don't act fast. What was going on here?
Yes. Well, certainly long before women actually acquired the right to vote in the U.S., there had been kind of bubbling up movements for women's emancipation. But in those years leading up to it, there was just a much more general cultural conversation about women's roles and conflict over women's roles. And hair was right in the middle of all those conversations. Are women becoming too masculine? Are they becoming too aggressive? And visible hair became a kind of emblem of those concerns. So gender was a big part of this, but sexuality was a big part too. What women's appropriate sexual roles were. Mustaches, beards, visible hair, especially on the face, was a central element of all those discussions.
Well, and it's certainly during the big social movements of the 1960s, the Black Power movement, the hippie movement, and body hair as a sort of battle line for feminism. When did leg shaving, armpit shaving become a central issue in women's fight for equality?
It didn't really become the emblem of feminism itself until into the 1970s. And a big part of this was the very first issue of Ms. Magazine. Some of your listeners might be familiar with a very famous cover with Wonder Woman holding a speculum on that front cover. But one of the articles named on that cover issue was an essay about body hair and whether removing body hair was actually a new frontier of the feminist struggle and women should stop this kind of tyrannical oppression of their bodies and put down their razors and their depilatories and so on. And after that issue came out, it really did become a kind of symbol of what we now call second wave feminism. And all kinds of people started describing, especially armpit hair, but also unshaven legs as the sign of feminist consciousness. That didn't last so long. We still associate visible hair under the armpits or on the legs with feminism, but the movement for women to stop shaving their hair was really pretty limited to the 1970s.
This points to one of the questions that kind of runs through the book, you know, whether hair removal is voluntary or it's an enforced social norm, you know, whether we consciously feel like there's something wrong with us if we have body hair or unconscious. I'm going to play a little clip here from the film of Sex and the City where this comes up as a topic.
What? I didn't know I was going to be wearing a bathing suit.
What are you talking about?
I forgot to wax.
Since when? 1998?
I've had other things on my mind.
I could be on death row and not have that situation.
Well, Samantha, when you're married, you have a different set of priorities.
Oh, honey, don't blame marriage. This man's married and she's not growing a national forest. How do you even cross your legs? Let me make you a spa appointment.
So that points to, a very funny sort of demonstration of, you know, what has become a social norm, the shaving or waxing of pubic hair. This is something that was pretty much unheard of in the year 2000 and is now ubiquitous. Men and women get waxed. Is this voluntary? Is this, or has this become a deeply ingrained social norm?
It's a great question. I think it's incontrovertible that it's become a social norm in a lot of ways. But that alone doesn't address the question of how much then volition or will do we as individuals have to intervene in social norms. And what I found striking is that that question has been at the forefront of American life since as far back as I could trace, certainly since the founding of the nation in the 18th century. Americans care a lot about that question. How willful am I? How voluntary are my actions? Do I have freedom? And what finally dawned on me is just how specific that cultural fascination is over whether we have free will or not. That in itself is part of American culture. And as women got more and more political and economic freedom, the question in feminist discussions of the body are, was it a voluntary choice? You know, did you get the breast implants because you really wanted to or because you felt pressured to? Did you shave your legs because you really wanted to or because you felt you had to conform to those social ideals? And even that question, how voluntary are our individual actions, is itself a cultural preoccupation along with hairlessness. And I think a perfect example of this, there's a lot of existing social science research on hair removal, and especially women's hair removal, why they do it, when they started, how did bikini waxing get so popular, those sorts of questions. But one of the things that is found across that social science research is that American women report that there are social norms governing all these things. There are social expectations. But they report that those norms shape the behavior of other women. But their own behavior, this research shows, the women report, is not shaped by those norms. So important is this idea of autonomy or free will to us that we attribute it to ourselves, even if we're willing to look out at other people and say, oh, of course, they're just doing these things because of social norms, but I'm not. I have free will over this question.
It's the American way.
Yes. Yes.
Well, Rebecca Herzig, it's a fascinating history, and I thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. This has just been a joy.
Rebecca Herzig, she's a scholar and a Bates College professor and author of several books, including most recently Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. You can find more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And now a story of hair management from the mouths of babes. When WNPR reporter Jeff Cohen's 5-year-old daughter, Sadie, noticed that her sister Eva's hair was getting a bit too long, she decided to take matters into her own hands. What resulted was one of the worst haircuts ever. Jeff sat down with the two girls to do what a reporter does best, get the facts.
Sadie said, do you want me to cut your hair? And I said, yes. I climb up on the bathroom to get the hair scissors, and they just kept cutting. And then I started getting and it was like so hard to cut. I was like, la 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 la. I started at the bottom, la la la. Then it went That's how it made the long piece and then the short piece.
So were you not even looking?
I was looking at her. She was looking, and she noticed that she cut it all the way to. Some of it was short and some of it was long.
Did you mean to cut off that much hair?
No.
How much hair did you want to cut off?
Well, I was just trying to cut off the curls.
And why did you think she needed a haircut?
Because it was all the way down to her, it was almost about down to her tush. And if she grew it any longer, it would make, when she wiped her butt, her hair would like go into the toilet. It'll be gross.
I did not like when it was almost down to my butt, and it was really itching my hips.
Now, did you think that you wanted a haircut?
No.
But you told her you wanted her to cut your hair.
Yeah, but I really wanted a hair cutter to cut it.
When did you realize that something had gone wrong?
When I was finished, and I put the scissors back, I looked at her, and I was like, this is bad.
Did Sadie told you to come downstairs and show us?
Yeah. And I said, you got my hair cut, Mommy. Isn't it nice? And Mama looked at it and she said, I heard yelling, Eva crying. Sadie, Eva, what were you
thinking?
Why were you thinking to cut your hair? I was crying and I said, Sadie cut my hair.
And I told you not to.
And what did you do with the hair?
I hid it under the radiator.
Did you think we were going to like it?
No.
No?
I didn't know you were going to scream like that, though.
Hair cutting it takes, like, a lot of concentration. We learned not to do it again. Ever again.
That was really, really, really terrible, but everyone does that kind of stuff sometimes. It happens, like, once. Or twice. Or three times in every life. Or twice. Or once.
What do you think about Eva's haircut now?
It's pretty nice. I can't imagine her hair long anymore. It's been so long since I cut it.
The Matt story, the most popular ever on the Public Radio Exchange, came to us from Jeff Cohen. Thanks so much for joining us today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org and on the new and improved NHPR app. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, on New Hampshire Public Radio.